Good morning. It's 7:59, February 16th, Thursday. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. She welcomes Arlene Goldbar to discuss universal income, gentrification, and resurrecting the WPA. Coming up at 9, it's Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program. Fight the Empire at 9:30. Fight the Empire dives into American history of foreign interference, obstruction, and assassination. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. Flashpoints at 10:15 with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Between the Covers, we welcome Ursula K. Le Guin, one of the foremost public literary intellectuals, with her new book, Words Are My Matter. Thank you, KBOO members, for bringing us all of this fantastic programming. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 8 o'clock. Voices from the Edge next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Celebrating 100 Years of Recorded Jazz event on Thursday, February 16th at 8 p.m. at the Fremont Theater in Portland. On February 26, 1917, the original Dixieland Jazz Band recorded the first jazz record ever issued, which will be celebrated on February 16th by the Cherry Blossom Orchestra presenting a concert playing full tribute to the trailblazing original. They'll be showcasing many landmark recordings from the first 25 years of recorded jazz. Again, the Celebrating 100 Years of Recorded Jazz event on Thursday, February 16th at 8 p.m. at the Fremont Theater. 2393 Northeast Fremont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. We are going to be bringing on Arlene Goldbar. We're in the process of trying to get her on the phone. But while we're doing that, let me tell you who she is. She is a writer, social activist, and consultant who focuses whose focus is the intersection of culture, politics, and spirituality. She is best known as an advocate for cultural democracy and a creator of cultural critique and new cultural policy proposals. Arlene was born in New York, but grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. After extended sojourners in Sacramento, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Mendocino County, Seattle, and the San Francisco Bay Area, she now resides in Laming, New Mexico, with her husband, the sculptor Yoshimoto. Arlene's work has addressed numerous academic and community audiences in the U.S. and Europe on topics ranging from the ethics of community arts practice to the development of integral organizations. She has also provided advice and counsel to hundreds of community-based organizations, independent media groups, and public and private funders and policymakers. In May 2009, she was one of the organizers of a White House briefing on art, community, social justice, national recovery, and national recovery, which brought more than 60 artists and creative organizers into dialogue with administration officials about the role in bringing about cultural recovery and sustainable communities. In 2015, she was named one of the 2015's 50 most powerful and influential leaders in the nonprofit arts. She was also named one of the 50 Purpose Prize Fellows, recognizing social innovation over 60, for her role as Chief Policy Wonk of the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. I could spend the next 10 minutes reading Arlene Goldbar's bio, or I could actually talk to her. Good morning, Arlene. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Joanne. I'm so happy to be here.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. And we're here today to talk about universal income gentrification and resurrecting the WPA. You think this time has come? And I love the connection to gentrification, so we'll get into that in just a moment. But first, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. And so you are a artist by trade, is that correct?
I'm a writer. Back in the day, I was a visual artist.
Oh, okay.
But I found out I'd rather tell stories than draw them, so I've been writing and publishing for the last few decades.
But you've really found a way to use art for social change.
That's true. Me and just tons of other people across the country, yes.
And tell me, what does that look like?
Well, Joanna, it looks like so many different things. Because, of course, there are lots of artists who make work that's about social issues. So they're making posters and murals. They're writing songs. They're making plays that are about the things that people care about, and they're using those arts-based ways of communicating to really reach people on more than just, you know, the intellectual level.
Yes.
But then there's also tons of people who are using art itself as a container for organizing, cultural organizing. So they're recognizing that when you bring people into relationship with each other and you give them the means and the encouragement to express themselves, not only intellectually, but, you know, with their bodies, their senses of color, of rhythm, of everything that makes up the whole person, that the activism that they do is so much more powerful and engaging. So it's not just the end result of making art about, but it's also the process of making art with.
Oh, I love that. And so let's just jump in. Universal income gentrification and resurrecting the WPA. Why do we need a minimum guaranteed income?
Well, that's really a personal favorite of mine, and it's a really, really popular thing around the world. So if your listeners are interested, the organization that sort of compiles most of the information is called BIEN.org, the Basic Income Earth Network, and they can find out more. For people who are artists or who are working in creative organizing modes, advocating a basic income as one of the 10 points in the policy platform that the USDAC released back in November, just 10 days after the election, was a really important point for us because we have noticed that the old mode of special pleading for artists, like artists are great, you should support them, you know, let's advocate for more funding for these agencies that give them grants, that really wasn't working. The National Endowment for the Arts, the actual value of its budget has declined by way over 50% since 1980. So we understood that we have to, like, raise all ships with a rising tide and that we can't just be for livelihood for artists. We have to be for livelihood for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about, a guaranteed annual wage, a basic income, the greatest thing about it, it's not means tested. And in the places where they've advocated and experimented for it, every person can get it. It doesn't matter your age, your condition. You can even get it if you're rich and you don't need it. But you save this huge bureaucratic expenditure of vetting, the way people do now with unemployment insurance or different social welfare programs. And you save the humiliation of people being turned down because they were deemed not worthy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a cost savings, too. It replaces all of those humiliating programs.
And so could you give me that website again? It is Basic Income
Earth Network, so BIEN. While we're talking, I'm just going to make sure that that's org, but I think it is.
Okay. That is, and so tell me, you have tied this to gentrification.
Yes.
And would you talk a bit about that? Is your premise that gentrification wouldn't happen if there was universal income?
No, I do. You know, that's not the plank of our platform that we think will address gentrification, but there is one. And Joanne, let me correct myself. That URL is basicincome, all one word, .org. It's BIEN, the Basic Income Earth Network, but the website is basicincome.org.
Thank you.
Let me take one step back and give you a little context for this. The USDAC is a network of artists, creative organizers, all kinds of allies, people who care about their kids' education, people who care about immigration, cultural rights. And we have been doing work with people in local communities all across the nation, inviting them to tell their stories in creative ways and turning those stories into works of art. I'll tell you in a little bit about the People's State of the Union, which is our current action. And when those people told us what they cared about, and these are folks in tribal organizations, in urban community centers, in schools, in just every kind of small town, rural area, major city across the nation. Some of the things that we learned told us about what the policy planks were that we should put out when we aggregated all that knowledge into something and made it practical. And so one of the other points in this 10-point platform, and people can download that platform from usdac.us/platform. One of the other 10 points is what we call a cultural impact study. And this is an idea whose time has truly come. Because, you know, it's been for decades a requirement that if you're going to intervene in the built environment, you're going to knock down a neighborhood because you want to build a new sports stadium or a freeway, you have to do an environmental impact study to determine if there's an endangered animal or insect or plant. And if you find that that kind of harm is going to be done, you have to do something to ameliorate it, or you can't build the thing.
Right.
So there's no comparable standing in law, policy, or regulation for human community, for human social fabric, for all the things that we build up in long-standing neighborhoods, the gathering places, the customs, the way people greet each other, the history that's embedded in the community, the sites of public memory like statues or buildings or long-standing churches. Right now, people want to tear down your neighborhood to build something, there's going to be a big conversation about money and nothing about culture or social fabric.
Well, this conversation is happening at a wonderful time, Arlene, because here, of course, we are certainly experiencing massive displacement of people and communities and rich people moving in and building mansions where little family homes used to be.
That's right. That's right. And what This is a place where artists have so much in common with everybody else because, as you know, Joanne, artists get used as like the leading wedge of displacement and gentrification,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
There's industrial space. It's cheap. They rent it. Mm-hmm. The boutiques and the restaurants follow. And because there's no protection for the cultural life and the social fabric of the community, money pushes people out, and then they have to go someplace else.
I'm loving this cultural impact study. I think that is a excellent term and excellent activity. I'm so sorry to cut you off, please.
Please, go ahead.
No. I just think that I just love just the idea of that. It actually forces you to think differently about communities.
It does. It does. And what if every planning commission, because we're starting local now, Joanne, right? We're not going to get stuff from the federal government.
No, right.
It's going to go the other way.
It's going to be up to us.
What if every planning commission, city council, county board of supervisors, whatever the entity is, had to do one of these and had to actually assess who are these human beings? What have they invested? What is embedded, in the streets and homes of this community that's worth preserving? And how can we protect them?
Oh, that is lovely. If you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Arlene Goldbard, and we are discussing universal income gentrification and resurrecting the WPA. And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And so, Arlene, were you finished with the cultural impact study piece? Because I want to talk about the People's State of the Union. What's up with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to tell you about that. It's just winding down now, but the second part is about to happen. So every year, this is the third year, we have run a national project where we say to people, look, democracy democracy is a conversation, not a monologue. No one human being can tell us the state of our union,
yes,
right? It takes all of our stories.
That's right.
So we have this really interesting, accessible, powerful, simple mode of dialogue called the story circle that a lot of artists have used for years, where it's so simple, Joanne. 8 or 10 people sit in a circle. They have an equal amount of time to share a story on the same topic. Everyone has to give them total attention, no contradiction, no disruption. And then after everyone's shared, the group reflects on what you've learned from the stories. In People's State of the Union, folks then type out those stories and upload them to a story portal. People can find out and link to the story portal by going to usdac.us/PSOTU, People's State of the Union. And hundreds of stories are up there now. And then those stories inspire a group of poets that we've invited to collaboratively create the poetic address to the nation. And that this year is going to be performed and live streamed on March 11th at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. And then people can see the video of that. They can download the text of the poetic address. It's really a powerful poem, a lot of different voices in it, and inspired by the stories that ordinary people all across the nation have told.
Wow. That sounds pretty fabulous.
It is.
And this has been the third year. And does the location rotate?
Yes, we had the first one in New York and then the second one in Philly and now San Francisco, and who knows where next year will be, maybe Portland.
Maybe. Hey, yeah. Sounds like an idea that could come to Portland very easily.
Yes.
I want to spend a little time talking about the WPA because I suspect that our demographic, only a percentage of it has even heard of WPA. Would you tell us what WPA is and why we would want to resurrect that?
Absolutely. Well, WPA stands for Works Projects Administration, and it was one of the programs of the New Deal in the 1930s under President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. What happened is that the Great Depression took hold in the country. We have economic troubles now. This is a different level of economic troubles because it wasn't about inflation. It was about stagflation and deflation. So even though things were extremely cheap, people couldn't get the money to even buy basic things like food. And if you Google that and you look at the pictures on the street, you'll see folks lining up for an hour for a bowl of soup and an apple by the thousands. So FDR said, okay, the public sector has to come in as an employer here, the employer of last resort, basically, and let's set up programs that are funded at the federal level but administered locally that put people to work. And there were a lot of different programs. People may have heard of the Civilian Conservation Corps. It built a lot of amphitheaters and parks and paths. You can still see those in cities around the country. But the biggest program under that was called Federal One, and it had It's interesting that the biggest program was the arts program. So there was a writer's project, theater, visual arts, and so on, music project design. They did a lot of amazing stuff. For example, many people who had been enslaved in the 19th century were still alive back in that day. And so they collected the oral histories of people who had that experience, and almost all the surviving slave narratives that historians draw on now were collected with federal government paychecks under the WPA. So, you know, that's an example of the amazing things that they did. The Federal Theater Project, there were 10 black theaters in states across the country, Oklahoma, and you know, places that we don't necessarily think of as the centers of African-American culture.
Right.
There was something called the Living Newspaper, you know, did plays about syphilis, which was the epidemic that people were worried about then, or about housing. The title of that was One Third of a Nation, FDR. That was a quote of his where he said, one third of a nation is ill clothed, ill housed, ill fed. So this was a huge program. There were, you know, in relation to the population, a huge number of artists employed to paint these murals, to work with people in workshops, to all the post office murals that you see, you know, those historical ones that you see when you're standing in line.
Yes.
Were created then. It was the widely considered the most successful of the WPA programs, and it lasted until the anti-communist witch hunts of the 40s came in and shut down all the government programs that were employing people.
Man, doesn't it feel like history is repeating itself? I could be sidetracking us.
History's repeated itself twice.
Yes.
The second thing that happened is that, do you remember CETA?
Yes.
Comprehensive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so CETA, which started in the mid-70s, similar to the WPA, was a program that was created primarily to respond to unemployment, not to help artists.
That's right.
And lots of different categories of people were employed. But just like in the WPA, there were a lot of reasons to put artists to work serving the public good. So CETA in the mid-70s, there were approximately $200 million federal dollars a year spent at its height to employ artists to do workshops in communities, you know, paint murals, teach poetry, all the things that we can imagine. And that, too, was shut down when Ronald Reagan came into office and said, no, government shouldn't be spending on things like this.
Mm.
So, you know, we have two amazing proven programs that are examples of ways in which we can invest in employing artists, and there's a ton of public good that comes from that. It's not just for the artists by any means.
Right.
And it's totally time to do it again. We're not going to get it at the federal level anytime soon, but I think cities, counties, and states can definitely experiment. Right now, there's an artist in residence program in New York City, for example, where people are put to work in the offices of agencies to help tell their stories mm-hmm. through theater or, you know, moving image media to the bigger world instead of all those pamphlets that those agencies put out that nobody reads.
Right, right. And so I have a question, because I suspect many of my listeners are saying, if you just gave a whatever the number is to every single person without any means testing, A, that would break the bank, and B, you would just exacerbate the inequalities that currently exist. What would you say to that?
Well, there's a ton of research on that basicincome.org site about exactly those questions, because you're right, Joanne, those are the ones that are going to pop up in your mind, mm-hmm. you know, as soon as you see this idea. What amazed me is to look at the figures of what it costs to enforce and deny people benefits under existing programs that would totally be saved because there would be no means test. Imagine all the people who work in all the welfare and unemployment and other offices around the United States whose, let's face it, for many places, the main purpose is to say no, right? There's more people who come in and are denied than
their resources, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So imagine those, all that money that's spent employing those people just redeployed on this basic income. And, you know, in most places where they're experimenting, they're not starting with a huge amount of money. Some of them are 10,000, you know, some of them are a little higher, but that, if you look at artists as a class, for example, also, if you look at people who do community-based organizing work, political work of various kinds where they're not employed by high power agencies, that amount of money can make the difference between scraping by and being able to do this work, which has tremendous social value, and just simply not being able to do it because you have a minimum wage day job that's occupying all your time.
Now, I noticed from the website that most of the conversation is taking place in Europe and Canada, Korea, but not necessarily in the United States. Is that true or not?
No, you're correct on that, and I wish I could figure this out because I've been making a study of it for quite a few years. I do not know why the people in the United States who are policymaking don't think we have anything to learn from other people's examples, but we don't like to follow things that have been established abroad. So, Finland just initiated a new experiment. Switzerland had a referendum on it. There's a number of countries where this is really taking hold. There's one group in the United States, and his name is going away from me, so I'm going to find that for you. It's in the full Standing for Cultural Democracy platform that I mentioned, which people can download again from usdac.us/platform. And there's a guy in Silicon Valley who has a ton of money, and he's interested in this as a social experiment. And he's been trying to pilot it with a group of families in Oakland. Here we go. It's called Y Combinator. And it's...
W-H-Y or the...
No, funny. Just the word, just the letter
just Y. Just
Y.
Okay.
And the second word is Combinator. And the this is actually a Silicon Valley, what they call a startup accelerator. Mm-hmm. Like people who have new ideas for high-tech businesses apply to this. And if they get accepted, they go to this kind of boot camp and they get development money and a lot of things that, we're all very impressed by have money-wise at least have started there. And so they make lots of money and they're looking for ways to to invest in social goals somehow with some of their money. I think, part of the desire there is to also reduce government. There's a kind of funny common cause, right, where they don't want to spend all this money
on social services.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So they're looking for a way to use the economy to affect that.
Well, Arlene, we have a caller on the line. If I, we're gonna take a call. Good morning, Chris. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. This is an awesome conversation. I really thank you for having Eileen on, and Eileen, thank you for bringing all this to the Portland area airwaves. I wonder, just heard you talking about. Trying to crack the code of why there's not a conversation around supporting the arts in the United States like there is elsewhere. And I wonder how much it has to do with, kind of the privatization of culture and commodification of culture here so that we don't see art as a collective effort that deserves support, but we see it as this kind of private pleasure that if you have the means that you get to enjoy and consume.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if it really has to do with the way that we have commodified culture and the kind of corporatization of culture that kind of isolates us and makes us think, well, I like what I like, and so therefore I consume art as an individual. And don't have any collective responsibility to supporting artists. I just have an individual responsibility to consume that which meets my aesthetic kind of values.
I think you're right, Chris, that attitude is pretty pervasive. And, one thing that emerges from that conversation for people is that when they say art, they think of something elite that takes place in marble halls with, red carpets and, mm-hmm. and velvet curtains, but they don't think of their own contributions to culture because, after all, we all make culture together. So, right now, since YouTube, we're kind of like a nation of filmmakers. Lots of people, kids included, are making movies, and some of them have a lot of impact. People sing, whether it's in, a church choir or community chorus. They take photographs. They do needlework. They do their own, projects in the shop of building things. They write tons of poems and hide them in a drawer. Or they're brave like a lot of kids today, and they do spoken word where they actually perform their poetry. So it's not just something that's reserved for people who have that kind of professional moniker, mm-hmm. artist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I agree. I'm an educator, and I'm actually part of a program called Slam Boo that works with middle school kids to do performance poetry. And the kids that most relish that experience are the kids that are marginalized in other spaces, and they show up at this program and find themselves in it and find that you know, they do get this opportunity to express themselves in community and work collaboratively. And yeah, so we're out here working to change that mindset with this next generation of folks. But I really feel like that's what we've got to work against, that we've got to get people to realize that they are making culture, and to get folks to become conscious of the fact that they are making these contributions and that those contributions actually do have value.
Yes, they do. Thank you so much, Chris. We appreciate the call. We're going to have to move on.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the work that you're doing. All the studies tell us that if students have something that they're excited about, they do better all over in their educational experience. So no matter arts, music, sports, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as they have something that excites them outside of the classroom, they do better in the classroom. So thank you. Mm-hmm. We're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Dee Dee. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this important thing. We're hearing all across the country that people are feeling anxious and depressed and helpless. And yet, when we ask and we see why there are certain people who are feeling the opposite, they're feeling energized and hopeful and healthier, it's because they're using the arts, and they're acting with integrity. So there's congruence between what they value and what they're doing instead of being powerless. So that's very healing, and it also reduces violence. But also I'm thinking that when you give your argument about having all this money saved that's now spent on offices and people employed to say no, we can emphasize that we're not spending money on the paper and the buildings and electricity and stuff, but for the people who are losing their jobs and are getting lower pay, we can help that be possible by saying, if you got into this work because you want to help people, it's discouraging when it's out of congruence, that there's a dichotomy between what you want to do and expected and hoped and what you end up doing. And so you're going to save your mental health and your physical health, and the strain and stress of saying no to all these people who are angry at you and scared.
Yes, yes.
And instead, now you have maybe less money, but you're not wasting it on your medications or whatever. Now you have more time to do what feeds your soul and your passion and your physical health. So for those in the middle, you know, who are losing their jobs, by not having to say no to people, we can help to define where can you say yes to yourself, yes to your calling, yes to your passion, and let them get on board if they want to take care of themselves and don't care about anyone else, or if they really want to help people and be more effective about it, or if they're just saying, you know, this job sucks, it doesn't give me job security anyway, I'm going to do what secures my conscience.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dee Dee, you know, you're making a point that spreads out from there to affect other people too, because one of the reasons that we're so interested in the public purpose of art and culture and creating art and culture to address social goods is because we want to have a society in which all of us are welcome to show up with everything we are, our heritage, our spirits, our feelings, as well as our intellect and our labor power. And right now we're living in a world in which the institutions really tell us we're unwelcome in certain ways. You know, people are denied what we call the fullness of cultural citizenship. That is, you may have the legal papers to be here, but you don't feel welcome in your own community. Your heritage is not embodied in your physical surroundings. Your historic contribution to culture isn't recognized while there's statues in the park to generals on horseback.
Yes.
And so all of those questions are really critical for bringing the whole person into the society in a way that everyone has the choices that you're talking about, to bring their creative selves to have the life of their emotions, to have their spiritual life be part of who they are when they show up in community as well as at work.
Absolutely.
And also, core to being an artist is being able to kind of look back and be an observer or a listener and think of things without that personal attachment. So you come up with a different way of looking at color or music or an issue, and being able to question what we think, to look at things differently, to be flexible and courageous, is what's necessary for coming up with the new solutions we need most desperately that are facing us in our culture. And having that sense of integrity that I feel this way with my body or my emotions in relationship with others, that's helped us heal the society and the environmental devastation we're going through. So the arts are essential as never before. And if we say this from a different perspective, using a little different argument, we might bring more people on board.
Thank you so much, Dede. Appreciate the call this morning.
Good day.
Have a great day. Any comments, Arlene, before I head back to the phone line?
I'd be glad to talk to the next caller. Thanks, Joanne.
You're welcome. Good morning, Harvey. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Joanne and Arlene. This is a very timely topic. I just tuned in recently, so what I might say might have been already said, but here it is. I follow tech very closely with the introduction of robots and robotic factories, self-driving cars and trucks, artificial intelligence taking a lot of white-collar jobs, and with the coming of 3D printers, where you'll have your own sort of factory in your home, it will diminish our job profile. And we have a choice there. It's homelessness, because people lose their jobs, prisons for profit,
right.
Addiction, alcoholism, abuse. It'll just go on and on. And we can change that. You know, Richard Nixon was the first one to introduce the guaranteed minimum income, and so he ran up the flag. But at that time, it wasn't the right time, and so we do need a national guaranteed income. And I feel that now is the time for that, and so it's really appropriate at this time. People will be freed up from their a lot of mundane jobs to go back into education and the arts, and lifting us, you know, out of a kind of a people who hate their job kind of environment to where people can actually get up, redesign their own days instead of being told what to do. And it'll also help to slow pollution, people commuting to work and all that. I think this is the way to go. Guaranteed national income. It's our tax dollars. Let the government return our tax dollars to us in a beneficial way, because otherwise it's prisons for profit.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, that what Harvey is saying here is part of a very strange schizophrenic reality that we're in right at this moment, because on the one hand, we have the president occupant of the White House and the people in the halls of power, and they are kind of navigating through the rearview mirror, right? They wish they could bring back an old world in which they are permanently on top. And then out here in the big world with the rest of us, we have a level of opposition that we've just never seen before. People are creative, determined, and even optimistic, even as they're fearful. And there are a lot of people experimenting with different ways to create a new economy, as well as ways to create social justice. I don't know how those two forces, what will happen when those two forces ultimately meet, but I don't know. My money is on the side of making the shift that Harvey's talking about.
It's a really interesting concept. I mean, I think for me, the biggest challenge is my approach would be to start with the people most in need of resources, right? And then maybe that's how you roll it out, so that you're starting with the people most at need. Once they're stabilized, and the system is proven to be more effective than what we're currently doing, then I think there might be you'd have some models to be able to prove that there's a reason to roll it out nationally.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That makes good sense. Yeah.
I mean, because as soon as we started having this conversation, I was thinking, well, I mean, we have so many people in society today that just don't have their basic needs met. And what if that wasn't the challenge, right? What if the challenge was figuring out how you wanted to benefit society? What if the challenge was trying to figure out how you could use your talent for the next generation? Rather than, you know, how do I eat today, right? Or how do I put a roof over my head today, especially in rainy Oregon?
Yes, absolutely.
If you're just joining the conversation, I am speaking with Arlene Goldbar, and we are discussing universal income, gentrification, and the restarting of WPA programs, which were a work project administrations right during the 40s. Was successful in the midst of the Great Depression. And then, of course, we had a big shift in our government, and then that went away. And then it came back, and then it came back in a different format, and then that went away. And so any practical advice for us to think about, how do we start introducing this conversation at the local level? You mentioned that cities, counties, states could actually start pilots. How do we even start having this conversation?
Right. Well, you know, Joanne, I love that you use the word conversation, because I honestly think that that's the foundation. Mm-hmm. One thing we've been saying is that the national conversation to create support for these ideas really hasn't taken place yet. So when you introduce concepts like this, it's brand new to people. You know, they just have their initial reaction. Right. We need to actually sit down and get comfortable with it, right?
Right.
So the, you know, there's several things that we offer to people. Each of the actions that we do has a toolkit attached to it. So for example, people can go to the website, usdac.us, click on National Actions, and download the toolkit that tells how to do the People's State of the Union or any of our other things on that level now. But also, this very day, we released a new tool that people can use, and those are USDAC Outposts. The mailing went out like 5 minutes ago, showing people where to click, but basically, you go to usdac.us/outposts, and an outpost is a USDAC node or hub that it just has to have four people who want to start it. And then we'll give people technical assistance and ways to connect in to having discussions about these policy proposals, strategizing with them about how to do it locally, helping them spread information to get people involved in future actions that can also create more of this conversation. So I absolutely suggest that folks take a look at that. I also want to give you a little preview of something that's coming up, because I think it could be very helpful.
Okay.
This won't be official until the end of the toolkit won't be released until the end of February, but I'm going to give you a hint now, which is April 4th is the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's Riverside speech, and I know you know that speech by heart just like I do.
Yes, yes.
It's the one in which he denounced the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and materialism. And he's kind of came out against the people who said, we don't want you to talk about what's happening in Vietnam, because that will impact the civil rights movement. And he said, as a person of conscience, that's not an acceptable option. We can't divide issues that way. And so that speech is so alive for us today, right? It's totally what we're facing right now.
Absolutely.
And we, with a bunch of partners and a lot of other organizations around the country, are doing things on that day, April 4th. So we're inviting people to read excerpts from the speech in public settings. We're inviting people to write poetry based on the speeches, to have open mics, to create images and upload those where they can be shared and used by other people. And if folks go to the website, usdac.us, and just put their
email into the blank there. They'll get news about all these actions as they come out. I'm mentioning that in response to your question about how to get started on these policy proposals, because I honestly think that in most communities, step one is let's get together, have a conversation. Let's find out what we have in common. Let's listen to each other's stories. And then what needs doing here?
Mm-hmm. That sounds like that certainly sounds like the approach to take, because I do think you've got to build the support, right? Because I think initially people will give you all the reasons why it's a horribly bad idea. But again, yes. The cultural impact study, I think, is something that people could start putting in place right now. I think that there are components of this whole master plan that if those pieces are in place, then that's the lens under which you're viewing whatever you're doing in the community, development, big public works projects. If you're looking at it through a cultural impact study, I think you would take a different approach to development and how you would want to look in. And whatever the development is, how it would feel in that community.
Yes, you're 100% right. And it's also, it's not even just development, it's zoning. Because in a lot of neighborhoods, rezoning has happened to invite businesses in a way that displaces people, even without new construction. So, you know, you have to look at all the dimensions. The great thing is in the platform, which you can get at usdac.us/platform, in the full platform there, there's a model resolution that you can just drop in the names of your entity that you want to pass the cultural impact study, want to adopt it, and just send that right on to the Planning Commission, the City Council, or even the school district or an institution or community center in a neighborhood. Start with that and move out. So it's a kit, you know, and it's right there ready for people. Very, very easy to adapt. And we would love to help people who want to work on it at the local level, too. So folks can write to us anytime at hello@usdac.us and talk about what's going on in Portland or any place and ask for advice on how to get that started. And we'd be so thrilled to help.
And are there communities that you're working in now that you're providing technical assistance to that are trying to push the envelope?
Yes, we're talking to folks all around the country. And in fact, we just, I mentioned that we released this policy and action platform a week after the presidential elections. And shortly thereafter, we made a call for people to come to us with proposals for ways to implement these policy recommendations. And we're thinking mostly of fairly small-scale pilots in a particular place that we can document, share the examples with folks around the country, and for pilots that prove really promising, go in with the people together to look for funding to go to the USDAC lab and really develop it full scale. So people will be hearing from us about quite a number of ways that different people are already experimenting with these policy proposals. And then we're having conversations, like you said, with folks, Lawrence, Kansas, New York, you know, all around the country who are thinking, is there the possibility of doing this here? I mean, the other policy point that we didn't mention so far, Joanne, is a policy on belonging. That is so needed right now. A few weeks ago, when the present administration announced the Muslim travel ban, which thank God the courts have put a stop on for a while.
Yes.
We immediately wrote to people and invited them to pledge to protect cultural rights and oppose anything that impinges on people's cultural rights. And we got a big response to that. And the next thing we're going to do about that is release an advocacy campaign for our policy on belonging. This is such a simple thing that every community should have a policy on belonging that states that every member of our community is valued, that we are going to vet all the public decisions that we make here to make sure that none of them create what our Secretary of Belonging on the USDAC National Cabinet, a guy called Roberto Bedoya, calls disbelonging, all those messages that get put out that say, yeah, you're here, but you don't really belong here. You're here on our permission, and we can withdraw whenever we want. Now, with this travel ban and the immigration policies, we're seeing that done in a really explicit way. It's not subtle.
Right. Absolutely. Oh, go ahead. Absolutely, I was going to say.
Yeah.
We're seeing that very profoundly, having really a chilling impact on even people who are lawfully in the country are feeling under siege. And I love this policy on belonging. I mean, what a wonderful, clear policy description. I love that. I think we have another caller. We're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Laura. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, and thank you so much. This conversation about universal income is just so deeply inspiring. It really gives me hope, even if I never see it in my lifetime, or greatly manifested, I should say, in my lifetime. There are examples of it here and there, but I have been trying to get something started here in Portland called the Third Age Initiative, after the Third Age Initiative that I learned about in Connecticut, where seniors are brought together, trained, and sent out to do activism in the community based on what their interests are and given a lot of support. And it was a highly successful program. And we have things like that here in Portland, but without the income component, it seems that the programs here in Portland are more for seniors who are enfranchised, those who have large retirement, et cetera. And I'm not one of those seniors. And I do a lot of activism, but it's a big struggle. And as you get older, you get a little tireder. And I'm trying to ground truth a Third Age Initiative program here that enables seniors to give forward to their community, but also gives them some kind of income generation opportunity, rather than having them compete in a job market that does not want them. And I've accepted that I'm going to work until I drop, but I still want to continue to participate meaningfully in the community with the skills I've garnered over a lifetime. And I think universal income would allow for something like this. But I think the senior demographic, especially those of us who aren't enfranchised, really, honestly, you know, goes to waste, sadly.
It's an excellent point.
You're right. I'm well into the senior demographic myself, Laura. So I empathize greatly. And one of the things that Joanne mentioned at the outset was that I had been named a Purpose Prize Fellow a couple of years ago, which is a prize that's given to people over 60 who are involved in just the kind of work that you're talking about. So you can see that there's a huge group of people in our demographic who want to contribute and want to have the means of being able to apply their time to the things that really matter. And I'll just say from my own experience that I'm one of the leaders of the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. My fellow leader and the co-founder and the person who really came up with the idea is a young man, 40 years younger than me, called Adam Horowitz. He's chief instigator while I'm chief policy wonk. And we've really learned a lot from working so closely across the generations. For example, in terms of organizing and speaking to a lot of different people, we discovered that if we can like something, if it speaks to both of us spanning 40 years, there's a great likelihood it's going to catch on with people in between those two generations. So I also really recommend working with younger adults and doing collaborations that are able to scoop in all those demographics, because we tend to kind of be siloed now, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. And seniors have so many talents that they could be sharing with younger generations. I mean, I've always wondered why we segregate seniors from very young young children, right? Because they can teach each other so much, right? The kids grow up in this computer age, and they could do it in their sleep from 8 years old. And there's so many talents that seniors have that they could share. And we just haven't figured out as a society how to take the community's wealth and interweave it so that it benefits the overall society.
You're so right. You're so right about that.
Thank you so much for the call, Laura. We have just about 5 minutes left, or about 4 minutes left. Anything specifically, Arlene, that you want to share with us as far as next step? I know that April 4th is going to be the launch of the toolkit. What else should we be anticipating or working towards?
Well, that initiative is also, it's called Revolution of Values, after what Dr. King called for. So have a look out for that when it drops, and we'd be glad to engage with people in Portland about taking part in that. We have a series of regional envoys that's a new thing for the USDAC. These are folks who are talented organizers who've taken on working with multi-state regions around the country. Mm-hmm. They just started in last month, so they're getting their feet on the ground. But the regional envoy for the region that includes Washington State, Oregon State, and California is called Catherine Canton. She's based in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I'm positive she's going to be up there one of these days leading workshops for you all. So I'm going to give her your contact information, Joanne, so you can know when she's going to be in town and connect her with other people. Yeah, but that's something definitely to be looking out for, too. And I would just put out a big invitation to everybody. It might sound like a government agency, but it's not. It's a people-powered department. We're doing it on a shoestring. We need you guys. It's the people-powered department just can't operate without people. And the more people who understand the importance of culture as the crucible and container to work out the just society that we all want to bring about, the more reach we'll have. So please do come to usdac.us and sign up for the email list.
You know, that you bring a question up for me. I have found with my work with the NAACP that there's been this insurgent of people that just want to get their hands dirty, right? They just want to do the work of actually creating a more just community. And it's kind of like they woke up the day after election and went, is this really the country I want to live in? And decided, no, it wasn't. Are you having that same experience of people saying, you know, this is a time for us to be like thinking big, thinking really creatively about what's possible?
Absolutely. In fact, we've had the largest uptick in people who signed up to be citizen artists, which means you just say, I endorse these values and I want to be on your mailing list and take part, since we started more than 3 years ago in the last couple months.
Uh-huh.
And participation in the People's State of the Union, huge. But more than huge, people are writing back to us and saying, I was knocked off my feet by what happened. Mm-hmm. In November, and this was an opportunity to really sit and face each other and be heard, and it changed my life, and I have a whole new set of things to do now, so we feel so good about that. You know, for those of us who've been laboring in these fields for a long time, there's a feeling of like, where were you, right?
Yes, yes, but, yes, right. But we can't say that publicly, right? You have to have a spirit of welcoming, right? Because
Absolutely,
you do want to say that. You want to say, well, shoot, I could have used you 10 years ago, right?
I know. But, you know, I was so inspired by an essay that Alicia Garza wrote, one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, where she said, she was in a room with people around the Women's March, mm-hmm. who had never marched before, never done any public activity like that.
Yes.
And she realized now is not the time to be cynical.
Yes.
Now is the time to open your heart and embrace this new movement. And wow, it is big.
It is. Yes, it is. I keep telling people I am extremely optimistic, right? They look at me like mm-hmm. they want to carry me off to get me examined when I say that. But mm-hmm. I am optimistic because there is this resurgence of people who understand the need to actually do the work and have accepted the fact that it will be uncomfortable. They will make mistakes. But again, you know, they've got to do it because it's the right thing to do. It has been such a pleasure speaking with you, Arlene, and best of luck. I'm going to stay connected to your website, stay connected to your work. I love the kind of ideas that you're trying to move forward. And I'm all over this cultural impact study document. So we will be in touch. Thank you. You have a fabulous day and appreciate your time.
Thank you, Joanne. I had so much fun talking with you and your listeners. I really appreciate being on your program.
Well, it's been our pleasure.
Good luck to all of us. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yes, I love that. Good luck to us all. Have a great day. I'll see you next week, same time, same place, same station.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Good morning. It is Thursday, February 16th. It's 8:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, it's Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program. At 9:30, Fight the Empire dives into American history of foreign interference, obstruction, and assassination. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. Dennis Bernstein comes in at 10:15 with flashpoints. At 11 on Between the Covers, we welcome Ursula K. Le Guin, one of the foremost public literary intellectuals, with her new book, Words Are My Matter. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 9 o'clock, and up in about 1 minute, Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This month, because of the membership drive, the Program Advisory Committee will meet Tuesday, February 21st at 6 p.m. KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month's film, Bayou Maharaja, is showing Thursday, February 16th at 7 p.m. Bayou Maharaja explores the life and music of New Orleans piano legend James Booker, the man Dr. John described as, quote, the best black, gay, one-eyed, junkie piano genius New Orleans has ever produced, unquote. Illustrated with never-before-seen concert footage, rare personal photos, and exclusive interviews, the